Thanks, James. Thank you to you and to the conference organisers for asking me to speak on this topic. I've been doing talks on 2DR for a while, actually. I started about 5 or 6 years ago, and I thought, oh, well, James is asking me to speak. That'd be nice. You know, I was basically, my speeches were more about theory and perhaps hints in the history of antiretroviral development that two drugs actually were okay in an era in which we all believe three was kind of biblical. And when I sat down to do this talk, I thought, this is good. I'll just sort of, you know, drag it out, sex it up a bit of new data, and Bob's your uncle. And then I thought, actually, there's no time for all that stuff anymore. I don't actually need to do it because there's been so much data in the last 12 months that basically, and that's the proof of the pudding, right? It's not about why it might work, it's about does it work. And so what I'm going to do here is, and you've seen a fair bit of data already, you're going to see a fair bit more data, and most of it's from the last 12 months on two drug regimens. These are my disclosures. And I'm going to talk a bit about oral 2DR, so we'll talk about Gemini, we'll talk about, which is a naive study, we'll talk about Tango, which is a switch study, and we'll talk about Sword as well. Not much on Sword. I mean, I think you all know about Juluca. It's now a product in the market, so I don't want to belabor it. I've only got 20 minutes, so I'm not going to talk much about it, but we'll touch on it. Talk a little bit about the long-acting injectable 2DR that's coming down the pipeline. And I'll talk about Atlas and Flare. It's a combined analysis, which are two long-acting VIV studies, which were presented for the first time in Mexico less than 2 months ago. Then I'm going to talk about Islatravir. Okay, say after me. Islatravir, right? Which is the new name of the MK-591, this sort of fascinating nucleoside translocation inhibitor, which is very low dose, highly potent, very attractive, long half-life, okay, as well. Probably would support weekly dosing orally. That's been given with doravirine in a two-drug regimen, and then I'll draw some conclusions. So why don't we talk about Gemini to begin with? Many of you will be familiar with it, but I'm going to spend probably, you know, a few minutes on it because I think it's probably in some ways got the most, it's the most complicated, and it's probably got the most sort of range of data. But most of you will know the study. So it's a randomised, active control, double-blind study, and it basically takes antiretroviral naive adults. And the important thing is about the inclusion criteria is you had to have at least 1,000 copies per mil, but you couldn't have over 500,000 copies per mil of virus in your plasma screening, okay? So they had a ceiling. No evidence of any pre-existing viral resistance mutations, any major ones. And the other thing, of course, is you couldn't have Hep B because we don't want to be switching people with active Hep B to lamivudine, which is probably, which is an inferior agent generally compared to, say, tenofovir, what's the other one? Tecovir, thank you, I never use it. So they then were randomised to either get D3, DTG and 3TC. Okay, quite large. You see 700 patients. 700 patients also got dolutegravir and Truvada, so TDF and FTC. And that's going to run for 96 weeks. I'm going to give you the 96-week data today, although the primary endpoint was actually reported last year and it's now in print. Which is a standard snapshot analysis at week 48. Okay, that was presented first by Pedro Kahn in Amsterdam last year, and he presented the 96-week data a couple of months ago in Mexico. From this point on, it will stay randomised, but it will become open label. So there will be another report in, I guess, under a year now. And then after that, they all roll over and they go on to a long-term cohort, all receiving the dolutegravir 3TC. Okay? It was enrolled in quite a few countries, so it's pretty broadly representative. Europe, including Eastern Europe, Asia, Latin America, North America, Australia. Okay, nowhere from Africa, but yeah, quite generalizable data, I think, in terms of exposure in different populations. Just very quickly, and for the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all this. I'm just going to sort of point out that this was a relatively young cohort, about a median age of 33. All right, predominantly men, right, predominantly white, two-thirds of them are white. And I've taken this slide just to show you the ranges of viral load. Now, remember I told you that you had to have a viral load between 1,000 and 500,000 at screening, but what happens is, and we all know this, that when you come to baseline, which might be 3 or 4, 5 weeks later, I think it was 35 days, you had to come back to go to baseline. Some of those people who had a screening viral load under 100,000 actually, under 500,000 actually had one over 500,000. So you can see here, not many of course, but about 2% of the cohort, 28 patients in total, had a higher viral load than 500,000. Of course, they were allowed into the trial. They'd already been enrolled. So that's a little bit of a test of how good this two-drug therapy is, because, of course, people worry about the potency of with two drugs versus the conventional three. But most people, as you can see, had, you know, viral loads in the sort of most of them had less than 100,000 copies. The other thing is that any CD4 count was allowed in, and they had about 9% of the cohort had a CD4 count less than 200 at baseline, okay? And there were analyses stratified for those two, both virological and immunological factors, as part of the pre-specified analysis. Okay, so here's the money slide, if you like. So what you can see is the D3s in the blue, the 2DRs in the blue, the 3DRs in the orange, and that'll be consistent through these slides. What you can see is a pretty impressive, as we know with integrase inhibitors, decrease, so that nearly everyone's sort of undetectable at about 4 to 8 weeks. And then pretty much following in parallel, here was the primary endpoint, which is about a 2% difference. I think it was like there's two studies here, Gemini 1 and Gemini 2. They're identical. They're just done in different geographic areas. I think from memory, Gemini 1, it was like 2.5% difference in favour of the 3DR, but the 95% confidence intervals crossing no difference, meeting criteria for non-inferiority. And when we get out to 96 weeks, it's about the same. It's about a 3% difference. The lower bound of the 95% confidence interval is well under 10%, which was what it was specified. It was, you know, no worse than 10%. And you can see that the upper bound is no difference, zero. Okay, now, the one thing that everyone really thought that would kill 2DR, and I still remember seeing this data for 48 weeks for the first time with a few people, and everyone's sort of going, wow. And it's still wow, right? In people who had confirmed virological failure and therefore withdrawn from the study, so CVW is how they... CVW, always do that, get the wrong button. CVW, that means confirmed virological withdrawal, okay? When they assay that first virological failure at above 200, they didn't find any resistance in either arm. And the actual rate of resistance, as you can see, is incredibly low. So if you look here for the pooled data, which is probably the most informative because it's a larger sample, and as I say, the studies are exactly the same, they're just done in different geographic areas, there are 17 failures in the D3, none of those failures had a detectable mutation, and the same for the dolutegravir, the 3DR, let's call it, the three-drug regimen, where they had about 11 failures. Once again, no resistance. So the consequence of true virological failure seems to be the same whether you're getting the two drugs or the three drugs. In terms of adverse events, again, there's a lot of data here. Let me just walk you through it a bit. Basically, it was, people get grade 1 to 4 adverse events. Of course, they do. No difference in terms of 3DR and 2DR. Slightly less numerically. No difference, really. That's just random difference. Importantly, for drug-related adverse events, about 20% were attributed to drug by the investigator versus 25% for the three-drug regimen. That's a slight difference. It actually is statistically significant, but it's what's more important from a clinical point of view, I don't worry so much about this, but I worry about this. Adverse events that actually lead to someone to want to stop and change their therapy or withdraw from the trial because they want to try something else. And when you look at that, it's only 3% in each arm. So people that wanted to stop because they couldn't tolerate the therapy was the same whether you were getting 2DR or 3DR. Okay, I wanted to just focus a little bit on this idea because I think a lot of people have been... A lot of the predictions were it's not going to be as potent, it's not going to suppress people as quickly. Now we're in the era of U equals U, and a lot of people like to use an integrase inhibitor not only because they're so well tolerated and they're fantastic drugs and they've got great results for the individual, but of course of the issue of U equals U. So from a public health point of view, you want to someone who's sexually active, you want to try and get them undetectable as quickly as possible, right? And so they didn't. There's an analysis within Gemini of the virological decline depending on whether you got two or three drugs. And I think you could see probably this result from the original money slide, which showed the actual decrease was pretty much the same. And sure enough, when they actually did deliberately look at that, you can see that these lines of virological decay, whether you're on two or three, overlap. So even though you're not getting a third drug with the two-drug regimen, you're still getting the same rapid rate of virological decay. This was in all participants. This is in participants with more than 100,000 copies, which we traditionally think of as a much more difficult set of patients to control. No difference. Another issue that people worry... This is a graph showing the proportion of, in both arms, under 50 copies at the end of 48 weeks, depending on your baseline viral load. So you remember at the beginning I said you had to be under 500,000 at screening, but some people were over 500,000 at baseline and continued in the study. And what you see is as the viral load at baseline gradually creeps up, you start, and this is typical of any study in HIV, you start to see slightly less proportion of patients reaching under 50 at 48 weeks. But what you can see here is that you couldn't make an argument, I think, from that illustration that the 2DR is any worse than the 3DR. They're pretty much overlapping, really. So it looks like, in terms of being able to suppress patients, and I would accept, of course, that this is a small sample. This is 1,000 patients in these two. This is 40 in this one. So this, you know, probably needs further work. But as a model, as a proof of principle, it looks as though 2DR is probably as good as 3DR, despite having quite a high viral load at baseline. All right. And you can see the forest plots, you know, one, it's sort of randomly around, no difference. So not very convincing there's any difference between the two regimens. The other thing is blips. People think, well, if you haven't got a third drug, maybe you get more blips. And we've been doing blips for years. I remember seeing my first blip presentation about 20 years ago at Croy, I think. Diane Havlier, I think, from memory. And basically, despite worrying about blips, generally, we've never actually found that really blips necessarily predicted future virological failure, necessarily. But they looked at that in this, again, because people worry about it. With one less drug, you're going to have more blips, you're more likely to fail in the future. Again, blue is the two drug, orange is the three drug, and I think this is a poster from IAS 2 months ago. But I thought this was the best illustration. It doesn't really look, again, there as if two drugs are likely to cause more blips than three drugs. In fact, if anything, it's perhaps the other way numerically. I don't think there's any difference between the two regimens, despite losing one drug in the DTG-3TC arm. Similar blip frequencies. And, in fact, in cumulative occurrences, there are 87, I think it says, in the D3, the 2DR, versus 109 in the three-drug regimen. So not much to suggest that 2DR will be any worse in terms of viral blips. Okay, that's Gemini. How am I going for time? Terrible. Is that true? I can't believe I've gone that long. You've wound that up. Okay, Tango, I'm going to have to go even more quickly. Tango is a study looking at... So this is a suppression study, right? This is you take people virologically controlled, 6 months with viral load, at least 6 months with viral load less than 50 copies per mil, and you randomise them to either continue on their antiretroviral therapy, which is usually listed as CAR, and in this case, very important, they all had to be receiving a TAF-based regimen, so tenofovir alafenamide, okay? And they couldn't have Hep B, and they couldn't have resistance, okay? They couldn't have resistance. So they get randomised to 2DR or stay on the TAF-containing 3DR. And this report was the first report, and it's at week 48. They're going to be a late switch in this study, and then they're going to go on to a continuation phase. So it'll be followed out to at least week 144. Okay. Primary endpoint at week 48. Let me show you the results, and it's pretty impressive, isn't it? It's not often that you get one of these graphs where you actually can't see the bars for the virological failure. There was so little virological failure you barely registered. So it was all non-virological, you know, protocol violations, patient asked to withdraw, incarceration, things like that, not virological failures. And you can see for both the primary endpoint and the secondary endpoint, you can see that there's really no difference. Point estimate, very close to no difference. Confidence intervals cross, no question about that. That's a non-inferior finding. once again, perhaps less surprising when you're taking a suppressed, so they're all less than 50 when you start, but there was no resistance. I think one patient in the 3DR did have a confirmed virological withdrawal, but there was actually no resistance when they tested the virus. All right. Adverse events, as happens in these studies, when you take someone, and I think the average time these people were on their initial therapy before they get randomised was like 3 years. That tends to be a group of people who are tolerating it, right? You lose all the people in the first year who don't tolerate it. So what happens is when you switch them to a new regimen, they tend to get more adverse events because the other people are fine. And that's what happened here. There were more adverse events overall that were drug-related, and even slightly more, 4% had to withdraw because of that, as opposed to the TAF-based regimen, and that's what we often see with these switch regimens. That's typical. Interestingly, the increase in weight was just having listened to Jenny's summary of this whole weight gain issue. In people, and I think you made this point, these people were suppressed only 0.8 kilos whether they were taking two, continued on their two drug regimen or three, so there was no difference. SWORD, I will do SWORD quickly. So I think you know SWORD. It's basically switching people again suppressed on a three-drug regimen with any third drug and switching them to either continue that or putting them on dolutegravir or rilpivirine. Okay, 48 weeks was reported a while ago. It's in press. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. I won't labour that. I'm going to actually report the week 148 data that was presented by Jean Van Wyk, who I think is somewhere in the audience. So you can ask him all about it after the session. What did it show? It basically showed, so this was an early switch versus a late switch. So basically, if you remember the week 48 data, 95% of people in the two-drug regimen, dolutegravir or rilpivirine, had the same. It was 95%, still undetectable at 48 weeks, and it was the same in the continued regimen, exactly the same. Very little virological failure. And what this shows is the same thing. You get a little bit of attrition in the early switch group. This is now week 148 in that group. And still about 84% of them are still undetectable. And if you look at the late switch, it mirrors. So late switch is very similar to the switch here, 95. And this 90 correlates with the time of switching to this early switch. So it's very similar. So it really makes it quite robust. Again, pretty impressive results. And certainly not inferior. Let's not too much about virological. This is a bit busy, I know, but I don't want you to read it. The point I'm trying to make is that there were three patients who developed virological failure was very uncommon. So there were 11 out of 990 people that had to withdraw because they had confirmed virological failure and they got withdrawn. Six of them actually had resistance, and all six only had resistance to the non-nuke. So we've still not seen in a randomised trial clear evidence of selection of resistance to dolutegravir, which is quite remarkable. And that represents 0.6% of the cohort had resistance after 148 weeks. Okay, quickly on to long-acting injectables. This is, sorry about the colours. In Thailand, they like you see colours like this. They love colourful slides. It reminds me of being in Thailand when I see this slide. These are pretty straightforward. So this is Atlas, and this is Flare. They're basically the same. This took ART experienced patients, like all the switch studies, and basically switched them to cabotegravir or rilpivirine just to test that they could tolerate it orally. And then once that's been proven, they go on one monthly long-acting injectables. Okay, and they come out to 48 weeks, and that's what was reported here. Flair took a group of naive patients, put them all on dolutegravir, abacavir, lamivudine fixed dose combination, and then switched them in similar ways. So again, you can pull the analysis. It's just one started treatment, treated, and the other were treated and then switched. So they all get switched to the long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine, which are these nanoparticles, one shot in each buttock, all right? And this is week 48. This data was first seen 2 months ago. And again, these slides are great because you don't have to look at them too long, right? Incredibly effective over a year, very little virological failure, most of it non-virological, and, you know, in terms of difference between staying on your treatment, oral, or going to the injectable, absolutely no difference. All right. This is just about the injection site reactions. What's interesting is people will start complaining of injection site reactions, and they seem to increase, their tolerance increases over the time. which is, I think, interesting. I guess they still get, they just get used to it, I guess, perhaps. But the important thing is they get lots of events, pains, it's like T20, right? Nodules, inflammation, redness. But again, in terms of actually stopping, only 1% of people ever thought it was bad enough they wanted to stop. Now, this is a biased sample. It's a group of people who know that they've got a one in two chance of getting the injectable. So, you know, these are people, obviously, who didn't mind the idea of an injection. Okay, so that point's taken. That's fairly obvious. But, I mean, if it were really bad and people, it was worse than people had anticipated, you'd think that more people would have actually stopped. So I think it's a reasonable indication that this is tolerable for people. The only question is whether a month is long enough. Maybe 2 or 3 months would be a bit more convenient. But, you know, when I talk to people about whether this is going to be great, depending on who you talk to, some people think it'll be an absolute boomer and everyone's going to go to this, and some people think it'll be very niche. And I really have no idea either way myself. I really can't predict. I think it'll be very interesting when it gets to the clinic. Very last thing is Latrivir. Say that after me. Is Latrivir plus Doravirine. 2DR. So this is interesting because this is now a different company. All the data so far I've showed you is from Viv Healthcare, but this is now Merck experimenting with this. This was, I think, quite a surprise. And it's very interesting that some other companies now exploring this. Briefly, it looks complex. It's not particularly. It's dose ranging. So in this part, they get three drugs. Islatravir at different doses. And look at the doses, 0.25 milligrams. 0.75 milligrams, 2.25. This is a highly potent drug at very low dose. And they were given Doravirine and they were given Lamivudine in this first part. And then anyone who was suppressed and at this stage went into the second part and they dropped the Lamivudine. So this is the two-drug therapy. So again, they're sort of getting people suppressed and then switching them, okay? And by the way, the control was, what's this called? Delstrigo? Delstrigo, yeah, Delstrigo. Delstrigo. I think it's Delstrigo in Adelaide. I think it's Delstrigo in Melbourne, right? yeah, so then they go to this. They drop the 3TC that are on two drugs, and then those people, who are undetectable, go on to a third phase, and that will depend on what dose of the drug Merck chooses. And I'm not, some of you may be aware, but I'm certainly not aware of what drug they're going to choose. So what does that show? So at the end of week 48, where you include everybody enrolled at the beginning, so at the beginning of stage one, you see this, pretty impressive, you know, up around the 90%. That's what we want to see. Anything less than that's really not going to cut it, right? These ones are lower because they actually, this is only 30 patient arms, right? This is the typical phase two study. There were four people out of here dropped out for various reasons. And most of it's there's a bit of virological failure, but also non-virologic. If you look at week 48, and don't do the snapshot, but you do the snapshot from the people that enrolled at the end of stage one, right, so went to two drugs, and they all were under 50, you can see that that then accounts for those patients who dropped out. So it's all around the 90 to even 96% actually in the placebo arm, or, you know, the placebo arm with Doravirine. So I think a fascinating study, and obviously that's going to bubble along over the next year or two as they bring it to phase three. So in conclusion, look, I think for me, 2DR with dolutegravir and 3TC is non-inferior to 3DR at 48 weeks and over 96 weeks in ART naives. At 48 weeks, the guidelines, particularly the DHHS, which Ashton follows, offered it as an alternative if you couldn't take a nuke. The question now is at the next meeting, will 96 weeks be enough of them to actually put it up there as recommended? That's going to be, I think, an interesting debate. I guess we'll know by the end of the year. James, you probably know when the DHHS is meeting. I think we do need more data in women, as we always do with these studies. We probably need to know more about high baseline viral loads. I think we need to know about if you've got the M184 3TC resistance, does it still work? And I think that's a hot topic which certainly Viv are interested in exploring. And I think all of these could probably be answered if you did a test and street study. So start them on D3 without really having all the baseline labs, and I think that's something Viv are probably exploring. I think switch to Juluca or to D3 looks pretty safe and effective on the data so far. I think it's really intriguing now that another company is exploring 2DR. That really opens the field up quite a lot. The problem is that if the attraction to Islatravir is weekly dosing, what does Merck give with it? Because at the moment, Doravirine, you have to give pretty much daily. don't know. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. And I guess, you know, are we reaching the point in final conclusion of being able to say, if two drugs is enough, why give three? Thank you.